they have not taken their job seriously and looking after their favorites and things like that.
No, but for instance, I mean, a factor which contributed to the defeat was maybe that they were too flashy and not, you know, everything good for their supporters, but no consideration for the common man. That sort of feeling?
Because they lost the common touch, that is true. But I won't say that in their policies or administration they neglected the common man. Now even this, I know the whole story of this rice subsidy, you know. Who introduced it? Sin Act.
Yes, sir. But
I remember one incident. That was 1951, November. Mr. Sennaga, 1952, March, 50 November, rice was selling at 30 cents at that time. Then there was a big rise in the price of coconuts. That was probably partly due to short crops here and partly due to very high prices abroad. So, most of coconuts are going out and earning coconut cheap. So they asked me to evolve a scheme to issue coconuts on a subsidized basis. Two coconuts each family or something like that. So I prepared the scheme. I said, this is going to cost a lot in administration. It will just be done all over the country. Probably do it in areas where coconuts are grown. And I gave the figure of how much it will cost. Then they asked me, how much will it cost to reduce the price of rice by another 5 cents? I said, well, it's about the same. So they plumbed out
on
rice.
But why? Why did they deal?
My instinct was not to oppose it because it was easier work for me, otherwise you had to set up a big organization.
Rice,
as they say, rice, we have the organization, we are already subsidizing.
Say yes. Sir, why did they take the decision? Was there a political reason or unpopularity?
Well, this is my later impression. I couldn't have formed the impression at that time. Because I myself, said, well, it can be done and I had to implement it. Well, they are probably looking to the next elections. To be able to say, well, we have it. Again.
But didn't you realize that the expanding cost it would mean?
No, that is one thing that I can't rationalize. Any government, even Madana government, the moment they came to power, the first or second cabinet meeting, I was called because they had given a pledge. The country that rice price, it was 55 cents at that time.
That they would maintain it at that price?
No, they would reduce it.
Oh, they would reduce
one of the plans.
And did they do it?
Then they discussed this and I said 5 cents, and the finance minister also finally said maybe let us stop with 5 cents reduction. Everybody else said, including the Prime Minister, we have given a definite place to a country, it must be a substantial amount. They reduced it by 10 cents, they reduced the price of sugar also by 5 cents.
So, you didn't feel inclined to oppose it at that stage?
Well, you see, my duty was to give them the figures, how much it will mean. I had all my career of the department. My experience was that they didn't look to me for definite advice, and even when I gave it, there was the chance of it being accepted. My definite duty was to place me on the facts of the situation.
That's in the picture.
Picture, yes.
And casting your mind back to the UNP cabinet meeting, who were those who worked strongly for it? For the rice subsidy idea.
You see, the rice subsidy idea started in 1943. It originated from Haksam, who was the finance secretary at the time. He quoted the example of England. England was subsidizing food. At what time they had to subsidize? The tune of about £300 million. Then the compelling situation here was that wage claims should be assisted, especially in the estate sector.
And they have to help them in other ways?
Because they had, in order to help the war effort, they had to sell the rubber and tea and all the cheap. So that was Haksam's motive. So, but sir, they agreed. You let the wages rise, in May, no, a minute more, but you are letting them.
Oliver, he agreed.
He also agreed. In order to keep cost of production going up, to subsidize rice. But at that time, the subsidy was not to escape. The political element came in later.
So, was the subsidy on rice prevailing from 43 to 51? Or was it taken off after the war?
43.
They
continued. Only it was never disclosed. You see, at that time, it had this practice of budgeting for the rice subsidy. Until 1948, we just absorbed it in our normal food accounts. You know, we were making profits on certain items.
So, but wouldn't the retailers and the wholesale dealers be aware of it? Be aware of the fact that government was subsidized?
Yes. They were all aware, but it didn't strike anybody to bring it up as an issue in Parliament.
So the 51 step was going further on a larger scale. So it was not a new principle then?
No, it was not a new principle. It only took a different
complexion
that the politician realized that this is a weapon for getting political favor.
Did any of the ministers oppose it in your presence?
But
and the meeting itself, when they were discussing this?
No.
Was OEG strongly for it?
Oh, yes.
But did you feel that in UNP times they were riding on the crest of a sort of economic wave, and while they were making all these profits, especially after the Korean War, they didn't plow it back into capital expansion and essential imports and things like that, something which would bring some more money to us?
Well, that charge is probably correct, that they didn't make use of the opportunity they had when the economy was fairly sound to launch on development activities. But I remember this rubber profits brought in a Korean boom. At least part of it they spent on the rubber rail rehabilitation. But at the same time they let the rubber owners, rubber estate owners have another part. That's the kind of thing.
Or they let the estate owners have what? Have some of the money?
Yes. You see, they could have channeled the whole thing into development.
I don't think some of the trees were sort of over squeezed. I don't know what the term is. Over
slaughtered.
The slaughter tank.
That was during the wartime.
Yes. Oh, I
see. That was done to increase the allies. They had lost the Malayan rubber.
Did that have serious effects on our industry?
Quite possible, because we started the rubber rehabilitation in 1952 or 1953. And the results of the rehabilitation we didn't realize for a long time. Quite possible that slaughter tapping had some adverse effect.
Till the rehabilitation came ahead?
Yes, it's only now the rubber production, only today, or last 1 or 2 years, rubber production has shown some increase stemming from the rehabilitation, the part, the portion that has been rehabilitated is just coming into bearing.
Where were you in 56 and 58 in Colombo?
Yes.
Throughout.
Yes, 56 I was from secretary, same ministry as Philip Brown was a minister.
What?
Philip Brown.
Have you any idea what led Sir John to dissolve Parliament ahead of time?
By possibly he thought that opposition was just growing and he, before it gathered strength, he thought he could get back not much difficulty.
How did you find Philip Goodwin there?
Yes, he was.
Was he a strong.
Quite sound on policy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doctrinaire or pragmatic?
No, you see. People think that he is autocratic and ideological and all that. But he has an entire practical side too.
Mm-hmm. So, did you have anything to do with the Petty Lands Bill? You helped in its formulation?
Yes.
What were his aims?
Well, he thought that that would prevent the exploitation. That's one reason.
Exploitation of whom?
Of the real cultivator.
Mm-hmm.
By the landlord. Then, the major objective was to increase the reproduction. The cultivator had a better share of his own labor.
This is typical liberal theory rather than Marxist theory.
In fact, only one suggestion I made, I still think that might sound Marxist, that might have brought better results.
Okay.
Because, you know, maybe due to the fact that his policies are not fully or properly implemented. But I thought at the time that instead of all this elaborate machinery of the Petty Act defining rights and obligations, purchase all the, in effect, nationalization
of the land.
Not even nationalized, no. I'm opposed to the state nationalizing agriculture, but
take one and give
it. Take one and sell it, give him proper title, that because that caters to the individual's instinct that they must own the land. Why to offer
a simpler process?
Yes. I mean, instead of.
So why did he.
Even a fancy price, and you have legislation to buy all the lands at a reasonable price, give it back to a peasant, the deserving peasant, at the same price.
But don't you need some machinery for that too? To do that, to give it back? Or to the existing
law? Well, that will mean it's a amount of administrative machinery for a time. Once that is completed, the objection to that was, well, the question of finding compensation. But even that could have been solved after so long for the large country. We have about, say, 700,000 acres of
Petty Lands. Yeah, but what about the survey department? They could have coped with the pressure. Wouldn't you have to give them plan?
Yes. But there are plans already
available
to a certain extent of the lands.
Not to all.
Yes.
So what did...
Even that could have spread over it.
Period of years.
Period of years.
What did Philip say to that suggestion?
The objection that raised not by Philip and by others also in the ministry was that...
Compensation
has to be paid. That because you put off paying compensation as they do other countries, and you'll be considered to be a revolutionary.
Yeah.
So he mentioned this, see, that he was not a revolutionary in a sense.
Yeah, but then why?
He won't go by stages in all these reforms.
Do you think he has achieved the aims he set out to achieve?
I'm not touching the subject, but. I would say that his objective has not been fully achieved, because one of his objectives is to increase the reproduction, giving a sense of ownership to the cultivator, make him take a real interest in not only bettering himself but helping the country.
But isn't it at cross purposes with the DLO, or with the LDO, Light Development Ordinance?
No, LDO has to do with the cow land.
Yes, that is true, but they are, they grant the land to the individuals. There's a permit stage and a grant stage. And it so happens that in practice, many of them let out portions of the land to others. So in theory, these are the sentiments.
Well, I suppose they are not selecting the correct type of farmer. Mm-hmm.
And your short time in the field as an AGA in Bettula and then in Kandy, I presume you had to implement this land development ordinance.
Yes.
And you held land custody. What did you think of the aims of this ordinance?
Primary aim was to extend the agriculture production, increase agriculture production. But this middle class scheme, as I call it, was a sort of failure.
The middle class economy?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
No, they, some of the land cultures might experience, you just have a handful of people apply.
You mean less than the land available?
Yes. And even those who take it probably have no resources to. They wanted to take it, but when they want to develop it, they see, they find they have no resources.
No
capitalized for them that time. The loan facilities were not available. That aspect was not considered, the equation of financing development through banks and cooperative societies and so forth.
How did you choose Alaki in cases where there was a great demand and a supply?
Well, he only went on the recommendations of the RO, who said more industrious type. Father was a good farmer and actually pretty good the son.
What about the question of landlessness? If one chap had little land, not enough for subsistence, and the second fellow had no land at all, whom did you choose?
No, not necessarily the second fellow, because you have to get the more efficient farmer first.
Yes, but how do you define that?
Well, if the fellow who is making good use of the little land he has, then better to give him any more economic unit.
But what if the landless fellow had a big family too? Did you take that into consideration?
No, not they have to. They have to earn their living by labor. Another, they have to take other employment.
And what was there, for instance, to prevent the headman helping his relatives and friends by providing one or two bits of false information when you held the custody?
Well, there's nothing to prevent that happening. Because in this matter, petitions were useful.
Did you follow the petitions up?
Mm.
Some people say that because you held it in the open with the whole village there, the headman...
Ah, yes, in fact, some people used to raise objections at the kachari itself.
But then, wouldn't the headman be such a dominant figure that some people are frightened to say anything?
I don't think so. Why? Later days, the headmen were all selected by vote of the people. That's it. Period. This was done. I can't remember what.
When you were 18?
No, later.
But didn't you feel that this ordinance was not practicable to apply, that you can't inspect the lots, you know, as it grows, as the lots increase? It's impossible to keep an eye on them. Surveys fall behind and all sorts of complications, right?
Well, that actually happened. Unless, of course, the holding had been handed over after allotment to the agriculture department, and administering the whole thing. But they never had too much on their hands.
Can you recall evicting any chaps?
There were a few cases that nothing had been done for them. Period, throughout the years.
Then, for instance, if a chap got this grant, but really he might just erect a hut there and have some other occupation and let someone else cultivate it on land there. I mean, that would be against the purposes of the ordinance, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So how would you find that sort of thing out?
I heard that that happened in the dry zone. Mm-hmm. Most of the Tajlians. I'm not in touch with what was done. Such problems didn't arise, Bajla or Kandy. Kandy and lands of him, mostly for vegetables and
small crops,
village expansion.
What did you feel about the condition of the peasantry whom you met at these cutcheries? Did you feel that they were, I don't know, starvation level?
No, not starvation level, but they didn't have enough to make a living.
Were they in debt?
Yes,
they
were in
debt. How did you sort of discover that they were in debt? Did they complain or...?
No, these matters, we go by the VRO's opinion.
Turning to 50s again, did your family suffer personally during the riots here?
No.
And I mean, were you called on to handle this food distribution for refugees and things like that?
No. That was done by the army at that time.
Uh-huh. Because, I don't know what Manipenny was. He seems to have had been called in to organize something by the OIG. I was wondering whether as a permanent secretary to the Ministry of Food, you were brought in with the emergency administration in 58.
No, I was still in the Ministry of Food. The question of feeding the refugees, we handed over to the army. Colonel Kumar was there at the time.
You didn't personally come under any difficulties, say political pressure from the SLFP and such like. In Bandana, I think this is Bandana's time because the Tamil single is an issue. But that, you see, now in the university...
I gave my views to others and I never stated them in public. But I sent a memorandum to Mr. Bandana, the Prime Minister, on this, how to solve the language issue.
of this?
Language issue, the Tamil Sinhalese issue. Something on the lines of this reasonable use of Tamil, but going a little further than that. He actually read, I was told that I sent it to L.A. He read through it and he appears to have commented, well, his suggestion worth considering and
Mr.
Yes, yes, yes.
I do, I mean, we know of Vandanaik as an orator and even say the man of ideas, but as an administrator, how is he?
Who?
Vandanaik.
In fact, I was directly under him for a short while when Philip resigned and he didn't want anybody to do food. He took over the food himself, food and water department. But in matters of food administration, he did seldom post his views.
No, I'd say in contrast to Philip, did you feel that Philip was a more practical type? I know.
No, you see, my opinion, Mr. Vandanaik, he man of liberal views, but he is not the correct man of action.
Mm-hmm. Not able to control the forces he represented. I know it's a bit of a touchy issue, this Tamil Sinhalese thing, but I raised it because I can remember sometime in the late 50s or maybe later, there are suggestions that university entrance be on a ratio, you see, Tamil Sinhalese. And I know that in the administration too, at the lower levels, they were discriminating against, sometimes against Christians, sometimes against Tamil. So I wonder whether you came across in your case.
You see, the if at all that Tamil gets ahead of a Sinhalese or an English, this kind of discrimination, it is not so much of based on race or language. It sometimes happens, I mean, for other considerations, like, you know, I know cases where a single friend of mine gives a recommendation on behalf of a Tamil man who's working in my department. Probably he knew him very well and he was
friendly
and so on. That kind of thing happens.
I was thinking not so much of the administrators, but of the politicians and the ministers sometimes, who had the power to do this sort of thing, perhaps to satisfy a voter.
Well, when the economic condition of the country will keep pace with nice in population and need for jobs and so on. So even politicians started thinking on those lines. Well, Mr. Sennaik probably thought why should employment go on the basis of race or... But I think they sacrifice, and those say they sacrifice efficiency for the sake of enforcing a policy like that.
What is your view on this question of food control? Because it is said that creating food control and more rules and more restrictions invariably means more black market activities, and sometimes one control means another control and you multiply in controls.
Mm-hmm.
And really it's very difficult to work.
Well, the fewer the control the better, but our plight is such we are not, we are left with no alternatives. Now this recent decision to reduce isolation, was actually forced on them by the fact that they consumed Bhupai the rice. Then I remember when Felix wanted to do that in 1961.
There
was a similar situation, but quite temporary. But Felix and others, responsible ministers, they thought that this was a time when they could not only solve the problem of the rice subsidy, I mean the problem of existing shortage, but also cut down the subsidy. And the government approved the measure. Later they had a second thought.
Right, there was a revolt within the party, wasn't there?
And I was told, find the rice, although it was difficult to find. And it's probably with a good luck, I was able to find the rice. That
where did you get it from?
Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Located there and got it. That was again piece of luck, I was able to get the ships within a week of finding the rice. So that stepped off the cut. But the present situation, nothing could have been done. They were forced to do it. My view was that this subsidy question should have been tackled long ago. It shouldn't have been in the first place allowed to assume these proportions. But every government was afraid to tackle it. They must admit that.
What induced them?
We can't also blame the parties because maybe that this cut has had its effect on the recent by-elections. You see, the common man, especially the worker, he is not prepared to listen to the argument of reality that, well, this is happening, we can't. You tell him you can't get the rice, it's a fact, you can't get the rice, not go ahead.
There's a shortage in the world market, is there?
Even if you pay high price, you can't get it. You see, Burma has said only so much and nothing more.
Don't you think that we should seek alternatives and that this is also revolutionary in that we have to educate the people to start eating something else?
That should happen years ago. Because they're all pinning their faith on making Ceylon self-sufficient in rice. Still, they have that idea. Well, it's good to have the idea and publicize it and get the cooperation of the farming class. But my view is we can have the self-sufficient. The politicians would like to say that. They always like to say, well, we have to be
self-sufficient. No, I'm quite convinced they can't. I mean, from 1840 to 50, they've been trying to become self-sufficient and they haven't succeeded and they never will. What gave the Felix Dias Bandaranaike and Mrs. Bandaranaike's government the courage to try this? Was it Felix Dias' personality or?
I think he was able to convince everybody in the cabinet that this was necessary.
Something rather needing that I'm interested in is Mrs. Bandaranaike as Prime Minister. In the first few years, wasn't she, because of natural shyness and lack of experience, open to all sorts of pressures and except perhaps in a few matters in which she had definite opinions, was she utilized by various pressure groups within the select?
I didn't get that impression. Well, early days of premiership, she probably was guided by the respective ministers to a large extent and also by the prominent officials.
But now, for instance, when you attended the cabinet meeting on that occasion, did you feel that she was in control, or really was someone else taking the main role at the cabinet meeting?
Well, on certain occasions she tried to put forward an independent opinion and get them to accept it. But I have also observed on certain occasions, well, she used to say, well, no, what are you going to do now? That's sort of getting or not to express the consensus.
Okay. And
then she says, yes,
let's
do it.
And who did you feel were the leading personalities there?
Well, at that time, really, it was...
Not CP or... No. Well, thank you very much.